This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Today we bring you a forum KCBW moderated at Sprague Library in Sugar House called Immigration Policy, the Arizona Experience, hosted by the City Library and the Enriching Utah Coalition. The forum explored Arizona's experience with SB 1070, a controversial anti-illegal immigration law in that state, and HB 70, a similar Utah bill being debated in the Utah House of Representatives. Our Arizona guests were Todd Landfried, partner at Southwest Policy Advisors, LLC, and spokesman for Arizona Employers for Immigration Reform, and Lydia Guzman, president of Somos America and Respect Respeto. We also had Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank and University of Utah Economics Professor Tom Maloney. We go now to our forum. Todd, I'd like to start with you. What industries in Arizona have been the most impacted by SB 1070, and in what ways have they been impacted?
Boy, a lot of industries. Construction, anybody that needs skilled labor has been affected. So that would be construction, certain trades. Hospitality is not, specifically skilled trades. Agriculture has certainly been affected. I think most businesses really have in some way, shape, or form, and let me explain how. When people talk about the whole issue of immigration, it really comes down to, I think to most people it boils down to this thing of just like, well, they're not here legally. And, the whole issue of their, coming here to work and find jobs and better their lives gets dismissed on in a lot of people's hands, but the fact of the matter is that's why they come. And so these people are out, trying to get jobs, and so they rent apartments. If they're here long enough, they buy homes. They plant roots in the community. It's not that they don't want to be here legally. The fact of the matter is, plain and simple, is they're here illegally because we don't let them come in legally. It's just that simple. You hear people talking about, well, why don't they come in the front door? I heard it a lot today. But there's nobody there who I think, if you actually sat them down and said, so describe the front door, can actually do it. And that's an important point because, unskilled labor, if there's only 10,000 visas a year for the entire country, 10,000, that's one with four zeros, that are unskilled workers are allowed to get to come into this country. Now, there's in talks that I give, I talk about a farmer named Tim Dunn. He's a lettuce grower in Yuma. And he needs 30,000 workers to bring in his crops. 30,000. Where is he going to get them? You hear this, people talking about, there's no job Americans won't do. Well, yeah, there are. And there are also jobs that Americans don't want to do. But the fact of the matter is that if it were true that there are no jobs that Americans won't do, then how come Tim Dunn has a hard time finding workers to cut lettuce? If those jobs are open, it's published. He advertises all the time. No one comes. So, what do you do? What is he to do? So, when you talk about impacts of businesses, that's one of them. But then you start talking about, so these people rent apartments, they plant some roots in the communities, they buy stuff, they're consumers. They buy things like food, they buy cars, they buy clothing, they buy services, they're regular human beings. But when they leave, those businesses that are providing those services or goods to them, they get hit. Why? Because their markets are gone. And when the markets are gone, business declines. And when business declines to a certain point, you go out of business. When you go out of business, it means that your suppliers no longer have a customer. And when their suppliers no longer have customers, that means they might have to lay people off. So you begin to see this kind of, this trickle down of problems. And, when you start talking about kicking certain percentages of people out of the, out of your economy. So, when you talk about, the broader question of, what industries are affected, all of them are because they're all consumers, whether they're consumers at kind of at the you know, just family consumers, or whether they're business consumers, because a lot of these people own businesses as well. You know, so it literally is all industries. What happens is they target, like there was a study that was done on loss conventions in Arizona as a result of SB 1070, and it was actually done by a group called Elliott D. Pollack and Company, which is one of the preeminent conservative economic research firms in the state of Arizona. I mean, it just, they are as unimpeachable as anybody you're going to find in Arizona that does economic studies. You know, they came up with a number that there's a $752 million hit that the tourism industry took as a result of SB 1070. So, you know, these are real numbers, but that's, you know, everybody gets hit. It's not just one sector. Everybody gets hit, whether you're a U.S. citizen or you're undocumented. Everybody gets hurt.
And along those lines, Tom, would you have every reason to believe that a similar law implemented in Utah would have a similar effect?
Well, yeah, I think the basic ties are the same. I mean, I think the emphasis that's been placed on the role of immigrants as consumers is important and gets left out of the discussion a lot. I mean, that's really where I think a lot of the sort of income-enhancing effects of immigration are found, and that's why you don't see sort of the harmful effects on wages that you might predict. I mean, they just generally don't show up because these are folks who aren't, you know, they're in the labor supply, but they're also doing all these other things. It affects taxes. If you look at, in our original report, we did some estimation, fairly rough estimation, of the likely tax contributions of immigrants. And sales taxes were a very large proportion of that. And so that has an effect on state budgets as well. You know, I think in terms of effects on the tourism industry, I would suspect, I don't know this for sure, that the tourism industry is at least as substantial a portion of the state economy in Utah as it would be in Arizona, maybe more so. And so to the extent that one would be concerned about boycotts and similar kinds of activities, you know, it could have a more profound effect, I suppose.
Yeah, no one comes to Arizona in the summer. They come here year-round.
That's right.
Lydia, Chief Burbank, and others have certainly voiced concerns about what the impact would be on crime here in Utah. Let's go back to what you were talking about. The impact is in Arizona.
Well,
Lydia, let's start with Lydia.
Then. Okay, sorry about that.
Sure, okay. Thank you. Since the passage of SB 1070, we've received an increase of calls to our hotline. Now, the calls that come in, as I mentioned before, are from victims and witnesses to crimes that are afraid to call the police. Now, some of the crimes could be something such as, my boss isn't paying me. Okay, he's not paying me the overtime that I deserve, or he's just flat out refusing to pay me. All right. Well, in something like that, you know, maybe those may not be a matter of life or death, okay? But it comes to a point where they just don't know who else to call because, you know, in a normal situation, one would think that they could call the police, even if they have something taken from them by a neighbor, which we've also had these type of calls. But now what's happening is that it's come to a point where I'm afraid to call the police even when I'm being harassed by my neighbor. Okay. Now, the more serious type of calls that we're receiving are cases like domestic violence. When somebody calls us and says, I'm a victim of domestic violence, I want to call the police, but the police may ask me for my documentation. Now, with SB 1070, we do know that the federal judge, Judge Bolton, did put a stay on that, and they enjoined that piece where the police officers are not to ask them for their immigration status. However, because there's so much bad information out there, folks are still afraid because of what's been said in the news. Folks are still afraid to call the police, right? Now, if the judge had not put that piece on there, the police officers would be obligated to not only check the status of the person, you know, ask them for their ID, but at the same time, if they don't, then any member of the public can sue the police officer. So going back to this case of domestic violence, if the man says, well, what are you going to do? Call the police? I'll have you reported, and you will never see the kids again. Okay, because that's usually the case with all of the folks that call us. Every single one who's a victim says that their aggressor usually says the same thing. What are you going to do? Call the police? Right? So, but in this case, with, like, let's say the domestic violence, I'm going to use this as an example. The police officer, with a good heart and a good intention, will take all the information from the victim, and then if the aggressor believes that the police officer isn't doing their job, then he's going to turn around and say to the police officer, why aren't you enforcing SB 1070, and I'm going to sue you. Now, there were some lawsuits that were filed from police officers saying that you put us in a very risky situation. One, because they don't want to get sued, and I'm sure that Chief Burbank could probably, you know, talk a little bit about that. And two is because the risk of public safety. The fact of the matter is when there's a strain on the trust between the police officers and the community that they have to serve, public safety is lost, okay? There's a risk to public safety. Another example that I'd like to mention really quick before I finish my piece is we had a serial rapist in Phoenix, and this serial rapist was, he was described by the victims. They drew this sketch, and they put it on TV, and the rapist was Hispanic. Everyone described him as Hispanic. He didn't speak English. He maybe, if he spoke English, was very broken English. And so in the way that this serial rapist was described, he was described as possibly a construction worker. And so there was a calling. If you've seen this man, call the police, call the hotline, call the police, call the hotline, right? Their hotline. But at some point, somebody somewhere, it clicked to them and says, well, wait a minute. Maybe someone's not calling because they're afraid to call the police. So it wasn't until the police department started doing outreach, not only in Spanish, which they've always done, but said, we're not going to start asking for immigration status. If you know this person, if you've seen this person, report this person. Now, this person happened to be living in an area that is a concentration of the Latino community. The Latino community was not hiding this element in there. Nobody wants this type of element in their community, especially the migrants. They don't want this element in their community. They did report this man only after they were assured that their status was not going to be checked.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. You're listening to a panel discussion called Immigration Policy, the Arizona Experience, recently held at Sprague Library in Sugar House.
Chief, let's get to your concerns about crime here in Salt Lake City and in Utah, and also what kind of response you've gotten from the legislature when trying to voice those concerns.
Wow, that's a loaded question. The thing that's interesting is we have in this country since the mid-90s seen a dramatic decrease in crime, and that continues today. And that is not unique to Utah, and it's happening in Arizona, along the border. It's happening in New York, Miami. I mean, it's a trend that's occurring, and you have to ask yourself why, especially in the face of the economy. What are we doing differently? And I'd love to stand here and say it's because of enlightened police leadership that we have this dramatic decrease in crime. But actually, I think it is more along the lines of the fact that we have gotten better. Following some of the black eyes of law enforcement, we have learned to work with our community. Community policing has gotten better. To the extent that we expect from our communities to help us solve crime, we have tried for years and years and said it's the police department or law enforcement's role to stop crime. That really is not true. We are the element that responds to crime. We are much better and more effective if we prevent crime through working with our community. And that's what you see when you start dividing your community and saying we're going to treat a segment of our population differently than everyone else. Those people start to turn away from law enforcement. We already have a conflict, I guess, that exists when you start looking at different communities. People who have come to America from a different culture, unfortunately, their law enforcement is not always to be trusted. And so they have an immediate mistrust of law enforcement to begin with. And so when we heap upon this that, okay, we're going to treat you differently, we're going to ask you different questions based on the color of your skin, how you sound, how you speak, how you look, than we are someone else, that creates a bias and a divide where we don't share that information back and forth. I think, you know, very eloquently, law enforcement across the country has seen a drop in the ability for the Hispanic communities that they serve to interact with law enforcement because of a fear of immigration enforcement, because they fear people are going to ask the questions. The other thing that is really important that often gets lost in the debate is the fact that how can you ever tell, especially a young police officer that I sit in front of and say, I want you to go out and enforce the law, and I want you to do so equally, without bias, without prejudice, but yet I want you to take immigration enforcement action, and you look across the room, how do you tell someone's documented or not? And then, more importantly, who do you choose to ask that question? If we're wandering into the area that we're going to ask everybody this question, that we're going to detain and stop everybody who doesn't carry ID, who doesn't, you know, fit the norm, that's a very scary place to be in. And in fact, it's one that we've been in throughout history at different times, and it's failed. It has failed to produce results, and in fact, in often cases, has seen an increase in crime as opposed to a decline in crime. And so that's really what my concern is, and it's one that, when you go and you present this information, the thing that is most alarming to me as a police chief and the most dramatic is when I look back and I think about Trolley Square, and I mean unrelated to immigration, but it's a very interesting situation because the young man who perpetrated this crime in Salt Lake City was a Bosnian immigrant. And in the middle of that, right after that event occurred, because of the fear that's created, the fact that it's very hard to wrestle with it. This could happen to anybody, right? Young man just chose this. We didn't have an enemy to point to. But had I stood up as the police chief and said, I'm going to round up or detain everyone from Bosnia, right, every immigrant, I think it would have been met with applause from a good segment of our community because of the fear that exists. And that's what drives this issue today, and that's what's so frustrating, is misinformation that's put out here that Hispanics are more criminal. Right? That even undocumented Latinos are more criminal, which time and time again, there's not been a single study that shows that. In fact, the studies show just the opposite. And we have used that in the past, not we as law enforcement, but we as society, to say we are not racially profiling people. 10 years ago, when racially profiling became a hot issue, the standard they used was the population density of the different races compared to the stop data. And if you were within, if 25% of your community was Hispanic, and you had 25% of those tickets that you wrote were written to those, then we said, well, we're not racially profiling. And that's been proven time and time again. But now we're coming back and saying, oh, no, absolutely not. They're more criminal. Well, that's not the case, and there's no studies to prove that. We're not operating with facts. We're operating under fear. And that's when we lose sight of what's right and wrong.
So Chief Representative Stephen Sandstrom recently modified his bill, HB 1070, to more clearly define what constitutes reasonable suspicion. For example, if you don't have a Utah ID, driver's license, tribal card, or other forms of ID, and to also make it optional for you to verify someone's immigration status if they're not suspected of a Class A misdemeanor or a felony. Do these changes affect how you think about this bill at all?
The changes are steps in the right direction. I still have a lot of questions to how. We currently in the state of Utah, because of Senate Bill 81 from several years ago, have in place that anyone that we arrest and book into Salt Lake County Jail is checked as far as their citizenship. And if not, the sheriff's office refers them to ICE, and it's handled that way. We don't, as local law enforcement, my officers do not have the ability to check against any magic database that exists out there. It doesn't exist. In fact, if we want to confirm the immigration status of anyone that we're dealing with, we have two options. One is to book them into jail. The other is to contact ICE and have an agent come out and speak with them and confirm their citizenship. Both of those are very cumbersome processes and put us in the place of taking action, again, that's different for a segment of our society based on the color of their skin, their accent, or whatever it may be. But that is interjecting bias into policing. And when we interject bias, when we don't deal with everybody the same, that's a very scary road to wander down.
One of the things also that I think that we should look at is when these types of legislations are being considered in, not only when it was being considered in Arizona, but in any state, when SB 1070 was going through the state of Arizona, the Arizona Associations of Chiefs of Police stood up against this bill. This bill was an unfunded mandate. It created the cumbersome process that Chief Burbank has just explained. Now, in a time where police officers and law enforcement agencies are having to cut back and scale back because of budget cuts and restraints, in a time where we have to go out and fight the real element of crime, you know, the real thugs, instead, you know, we're putting our officers in a position of having to be ICE agents. And that's not what a police officer does. We have ICE agents to do just that, to be ICE agents. We have police officers to fight crime.
Let me just make one comment on that, because the cost is certainly a factor, and it's one that always has to be considered. The time, the energy, everything that goes into any type of enforcement always needs to be considered. But even if somebody were to stand up and say, well, we'll fund that, right? Whether it's a tax, whether it's a grant, I don't care how you look at where you get the funding from, you have to fall back on it is fundamentally wrong for officers to be engaged in this type of activity. And so I never want anyone to lose sight that, yeah, funding is an issue, but it is certainly not the most important issue in this as far as law enforcement is concerned.
Tom, I'd like to address our next question for you. A recent study by the Pew Hispanic Center estimates the number of undocumented immigrants in Utah, and in fact, the entire region of Utah, Arizona, and Nevada has actually decreased over the past 3 years, which is contrary to what many would have us believe. If this is true, why do you think that is?
Yeah, that's a pretty it's a good read. That's a pretty provocative study, but I do think the numbers are sound, and what they demonstrate is that the number of undocumented folks in the country probably peaked about 2007, and has been falling sort of in piecemeal fashion since then. And I think that primarily it's a function of the state of the economy. I mean, I think, as was suggested earlier, I think what drives migration is the labor market, is opportunities in the receiving country compared to opportunities in the sending country. People are coming here to work, and you get more people coming when the labor market is strong, when the demand for particular types of labor is strong. We got large in migration into Utah when we had such a strong demand, in particular for construction labor and for those types of jobs that these immigrants were highly skilled at. And so I think the primary force behind the decline that we've seen has been changes in the labor market. It hasn't declined everywhere, and there are, you know, Texas, for instance, seems to have maintained an influx of immigrants during this time. And Texas, at least initially, wasn't hit, didn't sort of turn down at the same time the rest of us did, due in part to strong oil prices. And so that may be evidence in the direction of this being primarily a labor market issue.
Mm-hmm. Todd, many in Utah's congressional delegation and many members of Congress have said that when it comes to immigration reform, the first thing that we have to take care of is border security. And if you don't do border security first, they're not going to support anything else. What do you think of that approach?
Nonsense. You're trying to achieve something that is unachievable, and it's absurd. I'm sorry, it's just absurd. The real issue here, and I have to say, Tom and I had not spoken before tonight, but this is a jobs issue. You know, this is a getting people into the country with a legal process issue. This has got nothing to do with security. This is nothing but an excuse to spend a boatload of money building walls that have historically proven to be ineffective. As Janet Napolitano said, you build me a 50-foot fence, I'll give you a 51-foot ladder. These people, they're driven by something more than a fence, but they would like to come here legally. If you, in my view, if you consciously address the labor issue from a market perspective
and you create a mechanism by which employers can identify the types of jobs they have to fill, the skill levels they need to have, and advertise them. Put them on the internet. You know, it's just, you know, Mexico is not a third world country. They have the internet there. They really do. Advertise jobs so Americans can see them. You know, and if it's not filled the next amount of days or weeks or whatever it is, you know, let somebody from another country apply. And let them come in that way. You know, current immigration law requires you that if you want to come in on a work visa, you need to have a job. Well, okay, let's let them find a job before they even get anywhere near the border. Azure, we've been floating this idea of building Ellis Island type centers on the border. And anybody here not know what Ellis Island is? You know, I mean, Joe Arpaio's parents came in through Ellis Island. You know, so it can't be that bad idea. Let's use those as the clearinghouses. You know, instead of driving hundreds of thousand people through the deserts where they can die and where they're spending $3,500 or $4,000, somebody said the other day $5,000 to a coyote to bring them into the country. How about paying Uncle Sam to do that? And let them underwrite the cost of the process, you know, an expediting fee. We've had meetings with the Mexican consulate. They like the idea, you know, but go try and talk to members of Congress about it, and they're more, because I've done it. Believe me, I've been to the Arizona delegation. I've talked to every single one of them, you know, about trying to, you know, pitch this idea to them, and they don't want to hear the business community's idea. They want you to know what they're doing on immigration, which is nothing. So, you know, it's nice, and you have meetings with their staff, and you kind of nod your head and shake hands and walk out knowing that you've been completely ignored. You're not going to solve this by building a fence first. It's just an absurd notion. And I think more people need to be standing up and start saying, this is an absurd notion. How do you know, what's the metric for securing the border? You've got a fence? You know, the whole way. I mean, you can't even build a fence the whole way. You know, how do you know? How do you know when you've actually secured the border? What, no one's coming in? Well, that will never happen. It just will never happen. So I just wish Congress would actually sit down and pay attention to, people like us in the business community and others who have thought about how you can actually solve this problem. And listen to us in the context of, you know, we want to solve the problem. One of my pet peeves, with the HB70 types and the SB1070 types, is that they're always saying that, well, you know what? And because Russell Pierce has said this to us 100 times, you guys just want cheap labor. You know, you just don't want to pay market wages. That is so false; it's not even funny. Are there people out there who want to game the system? Boy, I'm shocked that some American business guy's not going to want to game the system. You know, it's a reality. But the simple truth is not everybody does. You know, most of us, we want to pay our employees a fair wage. We want to, you know, pay them for a fair day's work. We want to, be fair to our customers, be fair to our suppliers. And, we need to be looked at as partners in this and partners in the solution and not part of the problem, which is how we're being perceived.
So, Todd, would you say the immediate solution then is to simply increase the number of visas so there's more temporary labor, or is it to create a pathway to citizenship? Should that come first?
It's a combination of the two. It's not an either-or. It's a much broader thing. You'd say, okay, well, we're going to let 50,000 unskilled workers in. Well, that doesn't really help. You haven't really solved the problem. You haven't made it easier for businesses to get the labor they need, like Tim Dunn, who needs 30,000 people. Okay, we could say, all right, this year we're going to have 20,000, you know, unskilled worker visas. Well, he's still 10,000 short, but what about the other guys who have, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 or, you know, however? I mean, there's huge farms down there. I don't know if you guys have ever been out of Yuma, but those places are big. I mean, you're driving for miles, and it's the same company's fields. So it's got to be market driven. You can't come up with these arbitrary numbers. Even if you look at visas over the past decade, the numbers for family reunification or for employment have been generally flat. So even though we've known that we've needed more workers at different levels, Congress has not seen fit to increase the numbers. And since 1996, they haven't changed them. Well, why is that? You know, I don't know. But it's not just one or the other. When they say the answer is comprehensive reform, it needs to be comprehensive. You just can't cherry pick.
This is Politics Up Close on KCBW. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to KCPW at 88.3 and 105.3 FM with translator facilities at K287 AE in Holiday.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q, a daily mashup of arts, cultural affairs, and entertainment, and I'm proud to announce that Q is coming to KCPW later this month. We've got feature interviews with everyone from Leonard Cohen to Werner Herzog, Carol Burnett to Juliette Binoche. Plus, we debate the hot-button issues of the day, from censorship to stealth marketing. That's Q, weeknights at 6 p.m. beginning February 28th on KCPW.
Welcome back to Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. We return now to our panel discussion called Immigration Policy, the Arizona Experience, recently held at Sprague Library in Sugar House. Our Arizona guests were Todd Landfried, partner at Southwest Policy Advisors, LLC, and spokesman for Arizona Employers for Immigration Reform, and Lydia Guzman, president of Somos America and Respect Respeto. We also had Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank and University of Utah Economics Professor Tom Maloney.
Lydia, I want to get your opinion on another immigration bill being discussed here in Utah. There's a bill that would allow undocumented immigrants to get a worker's permit to work in the state without fear of prosecution if they, for example, take civics classes and learn English. Do you think it would be helpful for the state government to try and undertake this effort, or does that really have to come from the federal government?
Now, I haven't read the entire text of the bill, but from what I was told about this bill in Utah would ask for a federal waiver, if I'm correct. Now, years ago, when Jenna Napolitano was governor in Arizona, she attempted to pass a piece of legislation that would allow workers to obtain a temporary work permit. And this was a federal pilot project. She wanted to do this pilot project. But it just never flew. It never flew. She didn't have the votes in the legislature to pass it, and it was called amnesty. Okay? Now, it never got the support because of that. With respect to the English piece, you know, I think, you know, without having to put a mandate on there, I can tell you right now that any migrant that comes into this country knows that in order to succeed, they want to speak English, they want to learn English. In Arizona, we passed pieces of legislation. Actually, no, we didn't pass pieces of legislation. It was placed on the ballot, okay? It was placed on the ballot in that would eliminate education for migrants to learn English ESL programs. Okay? And on the same ballot, you had English only. So make up your mind. You know, it was two separate questions, two separate ballot questions. But so it did. It, you know, English only was English as the official language. So it was what it was. It's very conflicting. So you know, the English piece. Maybe it's a feel good. Maybe it's just the message. You know. But I'll tell you what. Right now, you know, I talk to a lot of migrants, and they all know that in order to succeed in this country, they want to. They have to learn English. They know that they want to learn English, and they're doing everything possibly that they can. But with respect to the work visa, you know, is that something that should be addressed at a state level? I believe that's something, Todd is absolutely right, that we have to fix it at a federal level. At a federal level, we do not have 10,000 visas. What, you know, Scott, what Todd fails to underscore here is 10,000 visas annually nationally, not for one state, nationally. Okay, we do not have enough visas to fill the labor needs here in the country. So do we need to fix it at a state level? Then it becomes a patchwork of piecemeal pieces of immigration laws when, in fact, we have to look at it on a federal level. If pieces like SB 1070, HB 70, that type of legislation is not going to fix anything. If we're going to fix it, it's got to be fixed at a national level.
Let me just chime in on that just for a brief minute. One of the anybody who knows me knows I like little anecdotes, and one of the ones that I like is there's a guy named H.L. Mencken who had a very bitter wit. And Mencken said one day that, well, men like to believe their wives are good-looking and their children are smart. You know, sometimes I feel when I'm talking to groups about immigration and we have to talk about this things like, that they make them learn English. Folks, let me tell you something, just categorically, they learn English. They do. You know, it is a lie. L-I-E is a falsehood. It is a lie. There's no truth to it. Can I be any more clear? That they do not learn English. They learn English as fast as anybody else does. It's the truth. Don't let anybody tell you anything different. So, you know, I'm here to tell you that your wife is ugly and your kids are stupid. But these are the types of memes that get tossed around, and because they're not challenged, they become part of this daily lexicon, and people start to believe it. And I don't know what the general beliefs are of all the people in this room, but let me just tell you something: most of what you hear about immigrants not doing X, Y, or Z is wrong. It's stone cold wrong. And you need to start questioning your politicians. You need to start questioning the people in the media. No offense. You need to challenge them on these things. That's how you start battling a lot of this stuff. So, thanks.
Tom, in arguing in favor of his bill, Representative Sandstrom has said he doesn't believe it will cost local cities money. He believes it will save them money on things like education. We pay taxes for education, and some of the students are illegal immigrants whose parents aren't paying income taxes. What's the truth to that? What taxes do illegal immigrants pay, and what don't they pay?
Well, illegal immigrants certainly pay sales tax, as I mentioned earlier, in our attempt to estimate some sense of the fiscal impact of these folks in the state. The majority of the inflows were out of sales tax. They sometimes pay property tax either directly or sort of indirectly in the form of rent that they pay. Some of them are going to pay payroll taxes, conceivably under false identification numbers. Some of them are going to pay into, it doesn't affect the state, but Social Security taxes as well. So I think, at least in our estimation, that the largest inflows were going to come in, again, through the behavior of these folks as consumers. And, this question of fiscal impact, that is the effect of on government budgets of immigration, positive or negative, and is it positive or negative specifically for the undocumented, is very hard to get at. I mean, it's just a very difficult thing to construct numbers for, especially in the case of the undocumented. I think the best estimates generally, really uniformly, I think, suggest that immigrants have a positive impact in the long term and overall on these kinds of things. But I think the challenge politically is that it's in the long term and overall. I mean, I'm sure that there are places here in the county where you could go into classrooms and you'd see, we know that our classrooms are quite full for lots of reasons. But, you see a lot of folks who, at first glance, you might say, well, these are immigrant children, and they're increasing the size of the classroom that my kid is in. It's affecting what we have to spend on schooling. And you can sort of see that immediately, and you can see that, in particular places more than others. And so the costs are sort of easy to see. I think the benefits are harder to see because, another way to think about that education is as investment, and the way it pays off is down the line when that child is able to work and be a contributing member of society. So the fact that I think a lot of the benefits are really long-term makes this, I think, a politically more difficult issue. And I think the distributional effects are hard, too, because there are places where newly arrived immigrant populations are concentrated where there will be strains on social services, at least for a time, and there are other places where there won't be. The average works out well, but there's distributional issues that are encountered along the way, and the costs are, again, easier to see. So I think part of the challenge for policy beyond, border questions and the number of visas is sort of working through that problem of the distribution of costs and benefits from immigration.
Lydia?
After the passage of SB 1070 in Arizona, we saw pockets of those populations that Tom was mentioning where there's a high concentration of migrant communities and Latino communities, and we've seen folks leave in droves in big numbers. It's the exodus of these families that are leaving our state because they don't want to be harassed that's causing a negative economic impact. Now, one would probably say, good, it's working. It's working. We want to drive them out. But I'll tell you what, when they leave, perhaps maybe there's only one person in that family who might be undocumented. Maybe the other person is a citizen. Maybe he's a business owner. Maybe he's the one that's providing, his business is providing jobs for other citizens. Okay, maybe the kids that are being yanked out of schools are U.S. citizens. And so what I've seen, and Todd can probably collaborate as well from, you know, what he's seen on other sections of town, is that some of the school districts are emptying out. There are school districts that have about a 50% population this year as compared to last year. Those students are suffering because now their classrooms are getting consolidated, okay? Teachers are losing their jobs. In those neighborhoods, we're seeing a checkerboard of vacant homes. When there are vacancies, lots of vacancies in homes, the chief can tell you that it increases the crime because those vacant homes are a magnet for crime activity to take place in those areas. We're seeing also vacant entire shopping malls. The shopping malls and some of the businesses in those strip malls, these are businesses that cater to the Latino community. Maybe they left town. I was talking to a lady who was packing up her bags and she was leaving town, and I said, why are you leaving? You're not undocumented. She says, yes, but all of my customer base, they're going to another state, and I'm going to follow them because I have to go where the business is. And she didn't take all of her employees with her, but she had to let them go. So it starts becoming a ripple effect, a domino effect, and it affects everybody, not just by the consumer power, but by everything else. Just one small example, just to put it into somewhat of perspective, if I left Arizona, by the way that I drink coffee, I know that there's going to be a Starbucks somewhere that's going to shut down. Okay, I mean, just to give you an example. So,
this is Politics Up Close on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. You're listening to a panel discussion called Immigration Policy, the Arizona Experience, recently held at Sprague Library in Sugar House.
Let's talk about the impact of E-Verify, the federal program that employers use to verify the status of their workers. There was a bill that would have made it mandatory here in Utah. The governor stepped in and eventually it was made kind of optional, and now there's this database so employers can say, oh, well, I'm in the E-Verify database, so you should shop with me because I use E-Verify. That's some people's thinking anyway. What has been the impact of E-Verify in Arizona?
Negligible. I'm sure some people won't like hearing me say that, but it really isn't that big a deal. You know, it is at first if you've got a large employee base to have to sit down there and actually fill out the form. Who here has actually used E-Verify? I'm it. Wow. Okay. I'm it. I've used it. You know, I've used it myself. I've had to go through the process of signing up, and it's not quite like getting an account on PayPal, but it's not that dissimilar. It's really negligible. I think what made the business people more nervous over E-Verify was not so much that they had to do it. It's just that they didn't really feel it was necessarily their job to have to do it. Immigration isn't an employer deal. You know, it's like I said when I first introduced myself. It's not that big a deal. There are instances where the database is wrong, and then that becomes a pain. It's a pain for the person if they are here legitimately, and if they're not here legitimately, you usually don't see them again. But the fact of the matter is that most people,
people want to be honest. I mean, they really are. And businesses are exactly the same way. So we haven't seen in Arizona with any of our members or anybody else that we've talked to. I mean, the company I worked for was in the construction business, and we had a lot of subcontractors. And they hire lots of folks. And, you know, you talk to them, people about it when it first came out, and it just did not turn out to be that big a deal. The biggest issue is the accuracy of it and how you handle false negatives.
I'd like to add that E-Verify doesn't work. Let me tell you why on different levels. Well, first of all, when E-Verify was first started, it started off as a federal voluntary program for each state. You know, for each state then started implementing their own local mandate. If you want to do business in Arizona, each person you hire then has to, you know, go through E-Verify. But the problems were two. Okay, one is the employers rely on the documents that are being presented before them that they are, in fact, legitimate, and they are theirs. Okay, now that doesn't mean that you know there's that the folks that are using E-Verify are breaking any sort of laws. They're just, you know, they just have to rely on the documents. Now, an employer can look at a document and say, well, you know, you did pass through E-Verify. Maybe those are your cousin's documents. But that employer cannot say to this new employee, because I'm still suspecting, I can't give you the job. See, now that would be a violation, right? Because even though, you know, you might suspect that those documents might be fake or they might not be real, but they pass through E-Verify. On the other hand, in our hotline, like I said, we receive lots of calls of different types. We also receive calls from naturalized U.S. citizens that have gone through E-Verify and they do not match on E-Verify. E-Verify will spit out something that says this person is not authorized to work. Wait a minute, they're U.S. citizens. But because there is an error in E-Verify that says that, you know, when a person, I don't know how, but they become naturalized, and then, of course, E-Verify is looking for their status through immigration, well, they're no longer an immigrant. Now they're a U.S. citizen. They're a naturalized U.S. citizen. So it becomes very difficult. If someone checks me with immigration, they're not going to find anything. Okay, I was born in this country, but they're not going to find anything on me. So I may be turned away and be denied the right to work only because I don't have any records in immigration. So that's what we're finding right now with some of the problems with E-Verify. There are some; those are civil rights violations because they're wrongfully denying me the rights to work, and it's becoming a huge problem.
You've been listening to a special panel discussion called Immigration Policy, the Arizona Experience, recently moderated by KCBW at Sprague Library in Sugar House. It was co-sponsored by the City Library and the Enriching Utah Coalition, and you can find a podcast of this discussion online at kcbw.org.